Hello and welcome to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me in a bit will be Tim Phillips. And boy, what a week last week. What a whirlwind of, political stuff that happened. Not to get into open sources Guelph territory, but I think we are all pleased with the result of what happened last week with breaking news over the weekend that Joe Biden is going to be the new president of the United States. What effect will this have on the movies? I don't know, but I guess Donald Trump is now available for more cameos, and we will all look forward to that. Probably not. Anyway, End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 3 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new dark western sort of true life tale, True History of the Kelly Gang, which you can now stream on the Netflix. Before we get into that, we're going to cover a bit of movie news from the last week, including breaking news as I'm recording this. It won't be breaking news when you hear this on Wednesday at 3, but it is kind of breaking right now, which is that Alex Trebek sadly passed away from pancreatic cancer. He was 80 years old. He said he wasn't going to let pancreatic cancer lick him. He's going to recover. Unfortunately, though, the statistics were not in Alex Trebek's favor. Pancreatic cancer is one of the worst types of cancer you can get. Especially if you're a man, because it can so often go unnoticed till it's too late. The fight was brave. The fight was well done. He certainly looked happy and healthy in his last days. He will certainly be missed. I was just reading the statement put out by Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau about how Alex Trebek instilled a love of trivia in everyone, and that's a pretty good thing that he left to us. You know, just a thirst for knowledge. Jeopardy wasn't a pure knowledge thing. You would go on Jeopardy to win money, but at the end of the day, the fun and you know, the know-how, you know, trading these little factoids. I mean, when you watch Jeopardy and, you know, you're on a roll with getting them right. I don't know if anyone else out there did this, but I certainly did as a kid, is, you know, watch Jeopardy with my parents, but, you know, also keep track of your tally, you know, as your, if you get the questions right, how much you would be making. I could probably do better at, I haven't watched Jeopardy in years, sadly, but, you know, I could probably do better at Jeopardy now. But having said that, you know, it always felt good when you watch Jeopardy and you get on a streak and you're winning, even if it's just on your own piece of paper in front of you with your pencil, keeping track of how much money you'd be making. Anyway, we've sad to lose Alex Trebek for sure. It's also sad in movie news, in release date news. I mean, it's getting harder to make release date news because there are fewer and fewer release dates for big movies on this calendar year. And we have seen, again, a big shift. Disney has officially moved Free Guy and Death on the Nile off the 2020 calendar. That means the last big movie to come out in 2020, if it doesn't move and people are watching it to see what happens, maybe it has moved already, because we do record this a couple of days in advance of when End Credits plays. But Wonder Woman 1984, it's still set to be released on Christmas Day. That could change, and has already changed twice. But as of right now, that is the last big movie, big studio movie anyway, that is currently on the calendar for 2020. There are a lot of little movies, of course. I mean, one came out this past weekend, Let Him Go, which stars Kevin Costner and Diane Lane. It is not a big movie. I mean, it's got big stars in it, but it's been certainly heavily advertised, but it is not Well, it's no Wonder Woman 1984, it's no James Bond, it's no Black Widow, it's no, I mean, even Free Guy, I think the studio Disney was really looking that that could make some bank at Christmas time. It's a Ryan Reynolds comedy, it takes place in a video game world, it's fun, it's snappy, it's colorful. But it's not meant to be. Another bit of news that they have this industry thing every spring called CinemaCon, which is a chance for theater exhibitors to get together and studios show them what's coming up. Like I said, that usually takes place in the spring in March, but they have pushed it back to August of 2021. So, I mean, there's a lot of practical considerations that people have about what's going on, that, you know, likely in the spring things will still not be back to normal. And, you know, if you're thinking about the big companies like AMC, which it's been assumed they haven't really talked about it much, but being on the brink of some sort of fiscal collapse or bankruptcy proceedings throughout this crisis, you know, could there still be an AMC this year? What kind of exhibitors are there gonna, I mean, the drive-ins are doing fine. The Mustang drive-in down the road here in Guelph is still open. Usually it closes on the Thanksgiving weekend, but it is still open for business at this point. And last weekend the weather was pretty good, so why not? But it's still, how many exhibitors are there going to be next year for CinemaCon? That is a big question. Another big question is what's going on with Fantastic Beasts, the franchise that was spun off Harry Potter, launched in, oh shoot, when was it launched? 2015, I want to say? Maybe 2016. But anyway, this continuation, not continuation because it's a prequel series. But as you may or may not know, Johnny Depp was hired to play the villain, Grindelwald. In the series, he makes a small appearance in the original in 2016. He has a bigger part in the 2018 sequel. Supposed to be back in the 2021. It's been pushed back to 2022 now. But regardless, it is shooting right now, the third entry in the Fantastic Beasts series. Now, though, without Johnny Depp. And this all springs from a complicated series of legal affairs. There was a decision in English court. This week, Johnny Depp brought a defamation case, a libel case against the Sun newspaper chain in England, because they mentioned him in a headline with the phrase wife beater, because of some alleged domestic abuse in his relationship with his ex-wife Amber Heard. The court made its decision this last week, Monday. And found not in favor of Johnny Depp, but in favor of the Sun, which is a really interesting take because, unlike Canada and the United States, libel, the onus for in libel cases is put on the press outlet, basically to defend itself. It's rather easy in England to bring a libel case or a slander case because the onus is on the others, like the publisher in this case, to prove that they did not slander. So it's fairly unusual that the courts would side with the publisher here. And I guess that is what pushed Warner Brothers, which is the studio that makes the Fantastic Beasts films, into asking Johnny Depp to resign. And this is aside too from other internal troubles with this franchise. I mean, they have J.K. Rowling, who has been the subject of a lot of controversy because of her stance on trans rights. She's part of this movement that does not believe that trans women are should be considered women or should be called women. And that has gotten her into more than a little bit of trouble. It certainly generated a heated backlash online. like famous Potter fan sites like the Leaky Cauldron have kind of like scaled back, trying to separate her from Harry Potter. And I mean, that's kind of her legacy. She's the author of the Harry Potter series and of these Fantastic Beasts movies as well. So I guess the thinking over at Warner Brothers is that, you know, they cannot have two big controversial figures like this on one project. And if someone had to go, it was Johnny Depp. The flip side of it is too, and I mean, the issue here is that this was clearly a difficult relationship, but I'm using the word difficult in a fairly flowery situation, but between Depp and Heard, I mean, we can never really know what goes on inside a marriage, but it clearly, the two of them together were fairly toxic, and there have been allegations back and forth that she abused him, he abused her, but while there's a lot of people who are coming to Johnny Depp's support in this, there has been a equal and opposite backlash against Amber Heard. There is a change.org petition demanding that she be taken off the Aquaman. She plays Mira in the Aquaman films in the DC universe. There's another petition demanding that she be fired as a spokesperson for the cosmetic firm L'Oreal. There's just like a lot of really profoundly negative stuff aimed squarely at her in the defense of Johnny Depp, and I it's not a good look. Again, we don't know what with absolute fact what went on in that marriage, and there have been allegations on both sides, but it's really hard to ignore the fact there is a persistent misogynistic attack against Amber Heard in the midst of all this, and that is wrong on numerous levels. Leave the people alone. At the end of the day, Johnny Depp has to shovel himself out of a great big pile of crap that has, his relationship with his ex-wife has a lot to do with that, but also has a lot to do with just a lot of bad news on his part about spending and about attitude and being difficult to work with. He needs to go and work on himself, and maybe the fans can just let him work on himself. He doesn't need you to come to his defense. He is a millionaire. Anyway, I'm keeping an eye on the time because we do have to get to the review this week. This is good news. A Jurassic World Dominion wrapped principal photography. It has had to close down shooting at least twice because of COVID tests. They've apparently ran 40,000 COVID-19 tests. It was the first major studio production to go back to work after the pandemic. They've been shooting in Pinewood Studios in England, the last few months, and they've been kind of doing it NHL style, where, you know, if you followed how they were running the NHL postseason, they were basically closed down some hotels. Anyone associated with the teams themselves stayed in the hotel. They lived in that bubble. When they had to go to the I can't remember what it's called now, but the rink, the arena, they all got on the bus, went straight to the arena. They arranged like a fitness center in Exhibition Place, and if they were going to that, they would all leave the hotel, get on the same bus, go to Exhibition Place, work out, get on the bus, go back, and they were doing much of the same thing for Jurassic World Dominion. There was also an interesting story, I think it was in Rolling Stone, where they're talking about how TV production is faring in the COVID era, and I believe it was Alex Kurtzman, who is the producer of the Star Trek series, said that COVID-19 precautions were costing his shows about $500,000 extra on top of the budget for each episode of the show. So $500,000 more. And when you're talking about TV shows, that is big money. On a production like Jurassic World, you know, an extra $500,000 per week isn't so big. But if you're shooting an episode of a TV show for $3-5 million, an extra $500,000 is kind of huge. And on top of that, they have to sort of use guest stars sparingly, because if you have somebody coming in for a day, and somebody on set has COVID, they're out of action for 2 weeks. They're not. Nobody's flying in from New York, and nobody's flying out to Vancouver, or you know, wherever they're shooting TV shows. Guest stars are, from what I understand, are being used kind of sparingly on the set of these shows. So, I mean, that's some of the logistics, and that's hard to get into. I do want to address this controversy. The Witches was taken to task for its depiction of people who are differently abled, because the witches in the witches have three fingers, which is a sign that they're evil. And a lot of people who are activists for people with disabilities took pretty great exception to that, understandably. So, in a little bit of local movie news, Jason Momoa was at the Harley Davidson shop in Cambridge, and they took a lot of pictures with him. Jason Momoa is a big Harley Davidson enthusiast and rides those bikes. And so, you know, it's nice for local businesses to have movie star fans. So Aquaman stopped by at the Cambridge motorcycle shop. A bit weird. I mean, he is more than Aquaman, of course, but, you know, we're pretty inland for Aquaman, unless he came up the Grand River. I'm just kidding around. Jason Momoa is in Canada presently. I believe he is shooting the second season of his Apple TV Plus show, where he plays a warrior in a post-apocalyptic landscape where everyone is blind. I believe that is the gist of the show. It's called C. Anyway, I will leave that there, because that is all the movie news I have. We will take a quick break, and we will come back with the review of the week, which is True History of the Kelly Gang. You are listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
Coming from Melbourne on a Sunday. Ain't no passenger trains on a Sunday. That means that any train that we see will be full of troopers. Now, when you hear the train approaching, we take position. The train will fall there after we've torn up the tracks. There shouldn't be more than 20 survive the crash. And we pick those off one by one. Bang.
Bang. Bang.
Bang. Stay close. Protect one another. You are warships, remember? Nothing gets through your armor. Fire! You're bloody bulletproof, boys!
Who wants it? Who's ready to go to war?
And that was a clip from True History of the Kelly Gang, which is the new film from Justin Kurzel, and it stars George MacKay, Nicholas Hoult, Charlie Hannam, Essie Davis, Sean Keenan, and Russell Crowe. So I'm now being joined on the line by Tim Phillips. Tim, how are you today?
Doing well, enjoying this late summer weather. How about yourself, Adam?
I can't complain. I can't complain. Elections are over. The winners have been made. The sun is shining. Yeah. Everything is right with the world, or it will be in a couple of months. So no complaints here.
Yeah. Yeah. Everything's good for now. Let's just hope it's good. And then in January, everything can change for the presidency. Hopefully there's not a lot more drama for that.
Yeah. Yeah, let's hope for no more drama. I don't think that's going to happen, but I have a feeling someone's going to make a lot of noise out the door. Anyway, speaking of noise, the review we're doing this week is True History of the Kelly Gang. Not the True History of the Kelly Gang, True History. I mean, so far as titles go, but
But anyway, True History of the Kelly Gang on Netflix. This was your choice, Tim. So why don't we start with why you wanted to dive into the True History of the Kelly Gang?
It caught my eye on Netflix. It looked like it was a real sort of in-your-face sort of Australian Western, which they call a bushranger film. And it looked like it would be something that would be very entertaining and different. And I also saw Russell Crowe was involved. It's interesting to see him in the picture, see what he was up to. And George McKay from 1917 was in it as well. So it's interesting to see his progression as well. And that just caught my eye few days, and then I saw it was in the top 10 on Netflix, so I thought it'd be a good idea to review this. It looks like a nice sort of epic Australian violent film.
Yeah, it's I'm trying to figure out why it has sort of ascended to the top 10 on Netflix with like so many different things to watch on Netflix. What is it about the history of the Kelly Gang?
And I think it's pretty striking visually, so when you see a trailer, you're sort of it really catches your eye, and that's something about the movie too. So in the trailer, I think they do show the cinematography and the music and you know, the visuals and the violence and the intensity of it. So I think that catches a lot of people's eye, and it did mine briefly. I didn't like watch the whole trailer, but it sort of just caught my eye, and I digged in deeper to see what it was about, and it looked very interesting. Based on a Booker Award-winning novel as well, True History of the Kelly Gang. And it's very interesting in that sort of revisionist genre, because it says straight up right at the start of the film, that nothing about this film is true, and then it changes to the title sequence, True History of the Kelly Gang.
Yeah. So. Yeah, there's definitely a tongue-in-cheek bit to it. I haven't read the book, but from what I understand, a lot of people consider it kind of unfilmable. It's kind of, from the sounds of it, it kind of seems like a Michael Ondaatje book in terms of, you know, Michael Ondaatje doesn't really write in like sort of strict narrative progressions from, you know, the beginning to the end. There's a lot of jumping around. There's a book of his, I can't remember the title of it. It's on the tip of my tongue, though, where it's about like a jazz musician in New Orleans. And it's kind of based on a real, well, it is based on a real person. There was this real person who made jazz music in New Orleans, but there was so little written about him that Ondaatje was flirting with the true history of actual stuff that was recorded about him, and then filling in the blanks with his own kind of narrative leanings. I'm not sure how much, again, because I haven't read the book, but it does feel like that sort of style with the True History of the Kelly Gang too, by trying to ascribe, you know, motives in an origin story. Again, I don't know a lot about Ned Kelly. It turns out was a real person in Australia in the 19th century.
He was, yeah. And they'd done a film in 1970, which I've never seen, but I'm a big fan of the Rolling Stones, so I've seen a lot of pictures of Mick Jagger, because he starred as Ned Kelly in the 1970 picture. So there's a lot of pictures of him circa 1969 with a big beard, and it was going to be a breakout role for him, but apparently there was problems with the filming and the promotion. And it was directed by Tony Richardson, really famous British director who directed Tom Jones and a lot of the British New Wave films. But yeah, apparently there's a Heath Ledger film too from 2003, which I haven't seen either, starring Heath Ledger and Orlando Bloom. So it's got quite a history, and you can see given the arc of the character from his origins, you know, dealing with deep poverty to sort of being this rebellious gang leader taking on the authorities, how that could, how that can really draw attention. And, oh, the Michael Ondaatje novel you're talking about is Coming Through Slaughter.
That's right.
It's the name.
I knew it was something Slaughter. I didn't want to sound like an idiot, though, because I did read the book. That book I read, But yeah, it is interesting because I did make note of that as well, that there have been past films based on the exploits of Ned Kelly. And I guess, I don't know, it's, you know, one person's, you know, one country's sort of like grand cultural figures don't necessarily translate to other areas, which might explain why we have kind of no knowledge of these other Ned Kelly films, other than the fact they exist. Again, it makes me wonder why this breaks through, why this is in the Netflix top 10. I have a feeling because and this is kind of speaks to some of my issues with the film. It speaks to the fact that it fits very comfortably into like ideas about why people become members of gangs and why they become gang leaders. You know, he grows up and I mean, basically looks like hell. Looks like a burnt out forest that, there's nothing grows there. Like, why are these people living here? It's like in the middle of nowhere. The mother has to sell herself to, you know, feed the family, even though, you know, the father is there supposedly. What do they do? How are they living out here? How are they making money? It's just this bizarre thing. And, you know, then we learn it's the dynamics of the family where the dad has issues. Mom is kind of abusive. She eventually sells Ned to this, I think he's some sort of cattle rustler. Or whatever the Australian equivalent
they call cattle bush rangers, apparently. Yeah.
and that's the Russell Crowe character you mentioned. And where he, you know, basically learns to, you know, shoot. There's a scene where the Russell Crowe character takes him to shoot this constable that has been harassing Ned's family as payback. And that gets Ned sent to jail, again, as a kid. And then he comes out and he's, like, in this sort of, like, fight club to make money. And the first half of the film is all these, like, terrible, like, criminal minds cliches of like what goes into making a criminal and making a bad guy. And it's hard to sit through just from a story and character perspective. What I especially enjoyed was, at least in this first half, was, and not in the second half as well, but you know, what gets you through the first half is the beautiful photography, the great production design. I mean, again, this place looks, where he grows up looks terrible, from a practical standpoint, but from a production design standpoint and a set design standpoint, it looks beautiful. And yeah, it is a beautiful movie.
Yeah. And those overhead shots, especially the first one, maybe it was a drone shot or, you know, of riding the horse through the forest at full speed, at full gallop. It's very interesting. And yeah, a lot of the photography reminded me of sort of like, and the story in general, a little bit like Barry Lyndon, Stanley Kubrick, sort of, okay, this is how this person ended up this way. It's a tale. It's from the past. How much of it is true? It's revisionist. So I thought there was that aspect to it, which was really cool, from like a visual, and the music was very unusual as well. And the music's done by the director's brother, who's actually in a band, and he's a singer-songwriter in Australia. He's in a band called The Mess Hall, which I'm not aware of, but apparently they're compared a lot to the White Stripes. It's a two-piece sort of blues band, and music's really big to this film, and you know, it's such a big part of Irish culture, so it was interesting to watch that and listen to that as well. And another Kubrick comparison would be like it's almost like an indoctrination, like you're saying, of the child playing young Ned Kelly. It's kind of like the start of like Full Metal Jacket, not as intense, but I don't think there's much in film history that's as intense as those boot camp scenes in Full Metal Jacket. But it's, you can see, you know, how he's forced into this life, how he seems to have he seems to know right from wrong at the start. The child seems to be aware of it, but just through circumstances is forced into this life. And as you said, you can look at it a couple ways. Maybe you might look at it, okay, this is sort of the cliched way that someone becomes, you know, someone becomes a monster or a criminal. But I did think it was affecting. And I thought the start, you could see how he had no choices but to turn in that direction. And Russell Crowe, as his sort of bushranger mentor, Harry Power, I think he does an excellent job. I would have liked to see more of him, but probably the reason we don't see more is because you need Ned Kelly to grow up, and he's just there during the formative years with the young Ned Kelly. So it's a small role as far as lines and screen time goes, but I thought Russell Crowe was excellent in that smaller role. And then you get, you know, there's like a jump cut, and then you see the George McKay Ned Kelly, the sort of like the punk rock Ned Kelly in your face, yeah. The right away. And you know, that's really, you know, in your face, and then it gets really violent. And it was violent before that, but it's sort of like, okay, here he is as a gang member, rebellious, you know, and with a lot of troubles. You know, he thinks back to his father and doesn't want to end up like his father. And it's interesting from there. I do think like the start, even though you might think it's sort of cliched, it has an intensity to it, which I think the second half maybe doesn't quite live up to. I think overall I can see why it's, you know, in the Netflix top 10, it's a really gritty movie. Really. It's like a brutalist movie. It's sort of in your face, you know, nowhere to turn, violent film, which I've been making for years. You know, Sam Peckinpah, all kinds of people have made those types of movies. So it's interesting to see one nowadays that's just so focused on that sort of aspect. And there, you know, there are some secondary characters and subplots, but it doesn't really dig too deep. You can just sort of see that this troubled Ned Kelly, he has nowhere to turn, and this is what he's forced to do in his life, which is interesting to watch, and I found entertaining, but sort of a film you kind of want to turn away from too, just because it's just so brutal and so gritty.
Yeah, it's interesting because the whole thing is told basically from his perspective, that he's leaving this record of his life for his unborn child. And thinking back on the movie, there isn't a lot of scenes where Ned Kelly isn't in them. So that slightly reinforces the fact that he's writing his own kind of story. And then there are at least a couple of scenes, and I'm thinking of the scene where he goes and harasses, Ned Kelly, but the Nicholas Holt cop goes and harasses Mary, who is Ned Kelly's, girlfriend for lack of a more formal term, but the woman who's pregnant with his child, where he basically harasses her, and that's how he ends up being taken off the Ned Kelly case, because he goes too far in questioning the girlfriend, Mary. And then we kind of only see Nicholas Holt once, when he goes to kill, when Ned Kelly goes to kill Nicholas Holt's constable, Fitzpatrick, that's the name of the constable. And then we don't really see what happens. We hear a gunshot, and we presume Ned Kelly shot him. And it's certainly, we certainly presume that, because we have seen Ned Kelly and the rest of the members of the Kelly gang kill cops, but it's not made altogether, like, that whole sequence isn't made altogether clear in terms of, like, is this, it plays into the whole, you know, question the narrator kind of thing. Is did this actually happen? Did the Fitzpatrick character really get kicked off the case? And if he did get kicked off the case, was it because he did this thing to Mary by holding a gun on her other child? Was it, did Ned Kelly make a point, even though he was taken off the case, of like seeking out Fitzpatrick and taking some kind of vengeance? It's not, none of it's kind of made exactly clear. And because of how it's presented, we're not exactly sure what to believe. And that's like a very small kind of particular question about the nature of everything that unfolds in the course of the film.
Yeah. And it's an interesting choice. Like you're saying, when they cut away, when the Kelly gang has captured the constable there, who is Constable Fitzpatrick, who has just been, a thorn in the side for the family. He's lied to them about how he's going to help out the brothers, keep them out of prison. He's been abusive to the whole family, and they capture him, and he's sitting there, and they're surrounding him, and you're almost expecting, okay, how brutal is this going to get? You know, you're like, is this going to be like a Reservoir Dogs moment or something? Is something going to happen here? And then it's just you hear a gunshot and a cutaway, and it's kind of an interesting choice, right? They're not really dwelling on any sort of revenge they're getting on this, or you don't even know, did he get shot, or did he, like you're saying, did he escape, or did he leave? Did they let him go, or is he dead at this point?
So, and we never see Fitzpatrick again, so we don't know.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting choice. It's surprising, which is good, because you think in like a standard film they would at least probably have a few minutes with him, and there'd be sort of like punch him or something, or you know, something would happen, right? But they've got him in the chair, and then you just you hear a gunshot, and that's it, right? Yeah, so it's really subtle in that respect.
It's so weirdly staged, because assuming it's in Fitzpatrick's house, but he's like sitting in a chair. He's surrounded by the Kelly gang. I don't remember if anyone's like holding a gun on him, or if it's just like the overwhelming force of all these like bushranger, burly men in dresses and being surrounded by him. And then, you know, Ned Kelly comes in and with a gun and holds the gun on him, and they have an exchange, and that's it. It's like, is this even an imaginary sequence as well? Like, is he, you know, pondering what he would do if he ever crossed paths with Fitzpatrick ever again? And yeah, I mean, who knows? I mean, there's a real, and I'm not sure how Justin Kurzel, the director, might feel about it, but there is a whole Guy Madden tinge to, especially the second half, where because the end gunfight, I think that's maybe one of the most perfect Western gunfights I have ever seen. But
and that's based on facts too. That one, I don't know how much it's true, but like the armor is true, that he wore armor into that gunfight.
Well, I'm not sure how much it's true that the constables were wearing like these black light white cloaks, but there was this strobe lights, like they're being beamed up by a UFO or something. But I mean, because of that, you're obviously seeing something through Ned Kelly's perspective, or, you know, that this is his brain of processing. This is his kind of last stand, or what have you. But there's a lot of that in the second half of the film, where there's a very Guy Madden sensibility, where it's like, is what you're seeing real? First of all, is what you're seeing real? Second of all, if it is real, how much is being embellished? If it's not being embellished, and if it's not real, how much of it is the author's imagination, Ned Kelly's imagination, and how much fact is he using in presenting this part of the story? And it's very... I don't know. You're really kind of paying attention to the details to try and figure out, like, try to separate the fact from the fiction, and it is really kind of it is both trippy, but it's also it has a very kind of, even though it's completely implausible in certain respects, there is a certain reality to it. Because it does capture, I think, the emotion and the tumult, and the idea of truth being stranger than fiction, because it, you know, there is a lot of truth in the movie too, but there's also a lot of fiction, and you know, maybe it doesn't even matter. I mean, maybe this is why, you know, we have legends, and you know, the movie kind of flirts with this idea of, you know, a country isn't made by its history; it's made by its legends, and maybe this is me reaching, but you know, you think about it, you know, outlaws tend to be a part of, you know, the most memorable parts of the history of any country. You know, Robin Hood. We don't like Robin Hood probably wasn't real, but I mean, he's considered a pretty big piece of British mythology. You know, the Old West, you think about all the characters from the Old West, Jesse James, Billy the Kid, Calamity Jane, that's who I was thinking of, you know, just all these characters who you may recognize the name.
Yeah.
And, all the movies and stories told about them probably deviate far from the reality of what they actually, who they actually were in real life. But it is also a matter of, print the legend, you know, between fact and legend, print the legend, you know, that old saying as well. And I think that's what Justin Kurzel and the story is trying to get at here, is that, you know, countries are built on legend, not necessarily history.
Yeah, the evolving storytelling that each country has its own legends. And obviously, this Ned Kelly's a popular figure in the legend of and history of Australia, given there's been so many depictions of him. But like you said, it's interesting now. There's one that came to our attention, you know. Back in 2003, I might have heard of one of the other Ned Kelly films with Heath Ledger, but didn't really catch my attention. So it's interesting now, and with Netflix, seeing it on a streaming service, it's there, you know, and it caught my eye. So,
and it's worth noting that this was released on the big screen in Australia, because it was, I guess, earlier this year. But it came out on Australia Day. So,
okay.
So, I mean, it speaks to, you know, sort of, which is January the 26th. So, I mean, it definitely speaks to, it's like, this is a pertinent bit of Australia lore. Ned Kelly is Australia. Australia is Ned Kelly. And to prove it, we're releasing this sort of true story, kind of based on his life, on the day we recognize the formation of our country, Australia.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course it's going to have so many aspects are going to be like the extraordinary aspects, and you know, how much is true, like you're saying. And it's interesting, once a film like this comes out that's getting a lot of eyeballs on it, then what's the next Ned Kelly movie going to look like? You know, even though they say up front at the start, most of it's not true. I think they said all of it's not true, but they even lied about that, I think, because I did some research, and I think when he's wearing the armor at the end, that's based on apparently true facts. But it'll be interesting to see like the next depictions and how they evolve, you know, and how much of the quote-unquote truth is still in it as it continues to evolve. This being a story of a 19th century figure, it's probably already evolved to the point where, you know, the majority of it's not true, and be interesting the more and more like this film inspires future films, you know, what they look like. And like you said, it being on Australia Day, it just seems like this is, you know, the rebel spirit of Australia right here. And and it's interesting that it would be released, because you think, like, what would be released on Canada Day, right? And seeing that this film is on, just how gritty in your face it is, just maybe says something about, you know, the spirit of Australia, because I couldn't see necessarily a film like this being associated with Canada Day, for instance. So
no, you probably wouldn't release like a Louis Riel biopic on Canada Day. It just, I mean, but we also don't have that same kind of rebellious. I mean, we have the same rebellious streak, but we don't necessarily honor it. I mean, and there's a very pointed statement at the end where the teacher that that Ned Kelly sort of converses with before his last stand is presenting Ned Kelly's biography as kind of like this story, and he's telling it in this kind of ballroom where everybody's in white ties and ball gowns, and so this is like the creme de la creme of Australian society, and very much not the people who Ned Kelly would have associated with or would have considered himself a fighter for. But here it is in this room with the, you know, the quote unquote elite of Australia, that Ned Kelly's story is being presented to a very rapturous audience who applaud and give him mm-hmm. and give the teacher a standing ovation. Like, what a great story. What a great tale of Australia. This guy who we invested so much police resources to hunting down. This is the story of Australia. And I mean, there's something to that, of seeing that dichotomy there of the elite crowd, applauding the story of the guy that the system ended up, you know, hunting down his associates and then hanging him. It's quite. And then at the end, there's this little coda too, where it's Ned Kelly's final request that his mother would be released from jail and that she would take his body and have it buried in consecrated ground. And then it says both requests were refused.
And, it's just like in your face. Yeah, here you go. And that's the scene at the very end. It's reminiscent of an earlier scene where he's doing the bare knuckle fighting. Ned Kelly is with the elite crowd at like the dinner party or whatever, the cocktail party, to watch him fight somebody bare chested, bare knuckled, in the middle of a room with everybody dressed up in their finest clothes watching it. It showed how he's like a spectacle for them, right? They don't respect him, but they like the entertainment value of having two poor souls fighting each other in the middle of the room. And it's kind of reminiscent of Django Unchained in that respect, right? You think of some of the bare knuckled fighting in that, and how he's Ned Kelly after he wins the fight. That's when the constable says, "Oh, I remember you from that event we had at the mansion where you beat up that guy, and that was great. That was awesome how you knocked his block off, right?"
Because he's being kept in his place then. I mean, he's Irish. I assume Irish Catholic in the Australian outback. I mean, times being what they were, Irish was not a cool thing to be where the Union Jack was flying. And, you know, so in the bare knuckle brawling ring, Ned Kelly was in his place and everybody respected his place. But as soon as he started, you know, wearing a dress and robbing banks and pulling up train tracks, he was a problem that needed to be solved. And by God, they solved it. And then lauded him for it.
Yeah. Yeah, it was it's an interesting film. You're talking about where they're wearing the dresses and how much it's really, it's a depiction of masculinity too, this whole film, right? Like the father, when you find out early on that he wears dresses, that's like seen from young Ned's eyes as being, you know, he's got issues that he's doing that. And then you find out later that they're doing that to, what's behind it is they want to throw their enemies off when they're battling them, make them think that they're crazy or whatever for wearing the dresses. But it comes back to that sort of old school sort of depiction of masculinity. And that's something that, it's a very masculine film, right? And there's some great, great actresses involved. I think Essie Davis and Thomasin McKenzie both are excellent in their roles. But so much of it is like Yeah, Ned Kelly, what does it mean to be a man? And his mother even is like, be a man, kill these people, you know? It's a very warped sort of sensibility, like what it means to be masculine. I mean, like his mother's even telling him, you need to kill these guys, you need to fight them, you need to do this and that. And the mother belittles the husband because he doesn't, he's not out stealing cows and killing them, and she wants that sort of masculinity. So it's interesting from that point of view too. And
right, it's so interesting in the early film where you are made to think that the father is let's say not following contemporary masculine norms because he's wearing dresses, but at the same time it is sort of reinforced by how the mother emasculates the father. Ned goes out and hacks a leg off a cow from somewhere and brings it home. And then, she starts hailing him as a hero, the great butcher, and at the same time emasculating the father.
Yeah.
And it immediately sets up this thing. It's like a man, will steal, a man will kill, and we will celebrate him for it. But if you are just trying to, go about life quietly and follow the rules, you are belittled and you are not a man. And it's really complex too, and it's also not straightforward, because you see a lot of scenes of intimacy, and Ned has this friend, I think Joe is his name, where you see them wrestling, and in the cold you basically see them cuddling for warmth, and there's like a real warmth, and it makes you think. Because you don't necessarily see a lot of warmth between Ned and Mary either. So it makes you wonder if, there was some sort of statement there about intimacy between men, and especially men alone in the bush. Maybe a kind of a bit of Brokeback Mountain vibe, but also not necessarily being about that either. It's just about, how does one be a man, especially in a tough environment like this? And it makes it very clear that there's kind of no easy answer. And there's certainly, at least in the quote unquote true history of Ned Kelly, there was no easy answer anyway.
No. Yeah. That was definitely a big part of it. And obviously the director wants to keep it ambiguous in those scenes, right? Like there's these, They're this is my mate here.
Mm-hmm.
Is it your friend mate or your mate, right? Like you're
right.
So he's sort of throwing it out there, and it's interesting in that respect. Kind of similar to like the scene where the constable's held hostage and you just hear the gunshot. It's like just sort of keeping things ambiguous and really really pivotal scenes or character scenes that develop the characters. You're not kind of thrown a little off kilter, which I think is cool and really interesting for the movie to make those choices.
And it's in keeping with the narrative, right? Because obviously if you are queer and male in the 1870s, you're not going to write it down. Especially in your own, your history that you're leaving for your child. Again, it plays into all this ideals of manliness and things. But I mean, given that place, given who Ned Kelly was, Irish Catholic, you're obviously not going to write down like, I was in love with this beautiful man and we were partners and, robbing trains and partners in life. And that's just not something you're going to share.
Yeah. Or if you did, it might get edited out by the gentleman reading it in front of the
that's true as well.
Well-dressed bourgeois, right?
Exactly. So I mean, it's an interesting film. It definitely captivated my attention. Great performances. It's beautifully designed and shot. I if it were me, I would have shaved off maybe 30 minutes of some of that family drama in the beginning, but I think it's I think it's well worth seeing on Australia Day, if not before.
It's coming up, Australia, I guess, a couple months. So
yeah. It's so mark your calendars, or even just watch the true history of the Kelly Gang. It's right there on, your Netflix top 10. So check it out.
Yeah.
Well, Tim, if people want to get in touch with you about Australian history or any topic, really, how can they find you on the internet?
Flash in the deadpan on social media. If you want to email me some Australian stories, flashinthedeadpan@gmail.com. Love to find out more about Australia.
And that is it for this week's show. We hope you liked it as always. And if you want to listen to it again, you can find us on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. You can download it on the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday on Podbean. Get it through your favorite podcast app at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. And speaking of Spotify, you can get that end credits playlist with all the music that we play on the show. You can find it in Spotify. Just search for End Credits on CFRU in your Spotify app. You can find us on social media on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show and on Twitter at End Credits Radio. I will be back on CFRU tomorrow at 5 p.m. for news and politics on Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. And in the meantime, I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson. I write about local politics at guelphpolitico.ca. And you can find my writing about horror movies at Nightmare on Film Street. And you can find that site at nofspodcast.com. You can stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. End Credits will be back next Wednesday at 3 p.m. for another fine edition of the show, and we will see you then.